Hello, everybody, and welcome to the free preview for this month's episode of What a Cartoon Movie. I am one of your hosts, the Bob with the tearaway face. I can only do it once.
It's me, Henry Gilbert, but to a man in Kentucky, I'm Mr. Unlucky.
Boy, that guy's a real jerk to you. What's his deal? But yes, this month for our What a Cartoon Movie podcast, we did Tim Burton's Nightmare Before Christmas. In case you don't know, What a Cartoon Movie is our monthly movie podcast for $10 patrons at patreon.com/talkingsimpsons. Every month, patrons vote for a movie, and then we cover that movie in a typically 3 to 4 hour podcast. It's a huge podcast, and we're going to give you a tiny sliver of it this month.
Yes, for an entire year now. We just did our 12th monthly What a Cartoon Movie, only for our $10 and up patrons. If you were to sign up now for 10 bucks, not only would you get to hear this one now, but also all of our previous ones from What a Cartoon Movie. Films like Aladdin, A Goofy Movie, Batman Mask of the Phantasm, Akira, Secret of Nim, tons more. You'd get to hear all of them right away. Over 36 hours of podcasting gold.
And if you sign up at the $10 level, you'll get all of our What a Cartoon Movies and ones in the future, as well as everything at the $5 level. That includes a ton of miniseries, the most recent of which is unrolling right now. That is Talking Futurama Season 2 Part 1. 10 new episodes of Talking Futurama to get you through the end of 2019, and they've been great.
All of that you can find at patreon.com/talkingsimpsons for $10 a month. You'll get so many things, tons in your RSS feed. So please sign up there. And while you're waiting, check out this little clip explaining how exactly Tim Burton ended up back at Disney to make Nightmare Before Christmas. As Burton is about to begin the massive amount of work that is creating a sequel to Batman, which everyone has been waiting for the second they got out of the Batman movie in 1989, he also wants to work on something different. And he wants to go back to his project of Nightmare Before Christmas, even seeing it as perhaps not just a special, but an entire feature-length film. That's when he finds out that Disney still owns it, and he can't just make it himself.
We own everything in your brain from 1978 to 1984.
Here's how Burton put it. There's this thing you sign when you work there, which states that any thoughts you have during your employment are owned by the thought police. You signed your soul away in blood when you worked there. They own your firstborn. I kind of gently ask, could I have it back? So that was the situation that he was in. By pitching it to Disney like 7 or 8 years earlier, Disney, even by saying no, they're like, well, we said no, but we do own it, so fuck you. As a Disney executive explained, they're like, oh, I guess we do own it. And they went back into their files and found the old agreement to restart it up.
We can make this without you if you want.
But yes, Jeffrey Katzenberg was high on the success of Little Mermaid by the start of 1990, so he definitely wanted to work with a director as famous as Tim Burton. But also, Tim Burton was so famous that even though he wasn't going to have time to direct it, Disney still wanted to brand it Tim Burton's The Nightmare Before Christmas, which was, one, to distance it, to sell it off of his brand, to distance it from the Disney brand, even at that early of a stage. And I saw Henry Selick also say that he thinks it's because, like, well, there's this thing called Nightmare on Elm Street, so the further we push Nightmare down in the title, it might help with branding as well.
I see that. And if you watch it streaming now, you don't see the Touchstone Pictures logo anymore. You see the Disney castle with the fireworks and the One You Wish Upon a Star that makes you cry a single tear before the movie starts.
I hate that.
I wish they would grandfather this into the official Disney masterpiece lineage, because it is a masterpiece, and Disney loves this movie more than they've ever loved this movie. Every year for the past, I don't know, maybe 15 years, they dress up the Haunted Mansion ride into a Nightmare Before Christmas ride for like 3 or 4 months. It's crazy.
Yeah, actually, this is the 18th year doing it.
Oh, man.
They've been doing it ever since a month after 9/11. That's how long they've been doing it.
What's this? Oh, no.
Oh, God. Yeah, but Bob, think of the poor Disney nerds who count every theatrical released film. And if you said this was now one of those, they'd have to say, oh, then this isn't the 50th Disney movie.
If Home on the Range is a Disney movie, this is a Disney movie. If Meet the Robinsons is a Disney movie, if Chicken Little
Dinosaur.
Oh, yeah. Get out of here with that.
Actually, Dinosaur will come up later in this history as
Has
well.
Has anyone actually seen Dinosaur? I'm confused.
No. That movie was such a cheat because it had CG things over live action footage. So, but you think that, like, wow, I've never seen them make leaves look so real before. It's because it's not. Ugh. Those are real leaves. Like, it's all just a trick. But anyway, Burton himself would even say that he has no patience for animation. It's why he was happy to leave it. If you can just be above that and just say, just do it, wouldn't you also? But Burton did know somebody felt would be perfect for it. Henry Selick, his old buddy from the Disney and CalArts days. Henry Selick, though, working on Slow Bob, was like, oh yeah, screw this. I'm going to direct my first motion picture for sure. So Henry Selick gets hired, and he's kind of working off a bunch of the lead designs that Rick Hendricks worked on a while ago, but Hendricks isn't really involved. It's much more Selick driving the artistic vision of it after he gets hired on. Like, he'll mention on that commentary I listened to too, of like, well, yeah, Tim and Hendricks, they have figured out a lot of the lead characters' looks, but when they're like, well, what's that Wolfman look like? They had to come up with it. Or what's Igor look like? Or the elves? Those things were much more driven by Selick and his team. But yes, Burton viewed this as a full musical, which meant before they even started writing the full script, they leaned on Danny Elfman to not just do the score, but to write original lyrics and songs for the movie.
Yeah, it's almost an opera in that if you just listen to the soundtrack, you get the entire story. The dialogue seems almost incidental between the songs.
We're not going to have a ton of dialogue clips on this, yeah. I'll say.
And I'm sure I'll get into this, but the songs are written first.
Yes,
and then the movie, like, they were working on the movie before anything was even finished script-wise.
Yeah, it's such a complicated production where, like, they hire Selick and he's doing pre-production, which is like building tons of shit and just also hiring up people. But meanwhile, Burton is hammered out the plot and he's got it kind of beat by beat, but it's all about the song, so he's talking through the songs with Elfman of like, hey, I think, this song is about this sequence, this song is this sequence, and then Elfman would go like, I got it, okay. He'd write a song, come back to Burton, and they'd with a song in a few days, and then they'd work through that song and just go song by song until they became the final song, which the song had to be finalized for them to start animating it, because the animation is so precise, you got to have the song set. You can't decide like, I want Jack to say this line instead.
You can't animate to a temp track for music.
I think with the way the stop motion looks like, the lip sync is so well done that ADR is even more standout.
Yeah.
Yeah. Elfman is writing all the songs. He feels very much in touch with Jack Skellington. He says, especially, he compares it to the Skellington hating his old routine and wanting to start something new as how he felt of like, I'm tired of Oingo Boingo. I want to do something new. The visit to Christmastown is the first time he wrote music for a film. Hmm. He puts so much of himself in Skellington that he even sings the songs, which he thinks are going to be temp tracks. He sings all the songs, so even when it's not Skellington singing, the first tracks are sung by him. But as it goes, like, no, you are Jack Skellington. We're keeping those songs as you. Like, you're the final voice there. As he's writing the song, Selick is building Skellington Productions in the SoMa area of San Francisco, which me and Bob know, which, like, in 1991 had to not be the best looking
colorfully
area.
Described as the rat's nest.
Selick said he chose to stay in the Bay Area because, for one reason, it kept him very distant from Disney, so it was much harder for them to note everything. They'd have to fly up to San Francisco to say, oh, that shouldn't be that, and that shouldn't be that, like, in the early days before, like, really teleconferencing and email were a big thing.
It's sort of like how Mystery Science Theater was protected by working in Minnesota, not LA.
And also, though, he was right to stay in San Francisco because it was surprisingly a hotbed of stop-motion animators, like, a ton of experience here.
Yes, they're actually working on not Skellington, but Art Clokey Studio was making the Gumby movie.
Yes.
A movie with Gumby in it that was never released to theaters. It is rancid.
Terrible.
And I remember reading in the old magazine Wild Cartoon Kingdom a whole feature on the Gumby movie. And they said a lot of people working on Nightmare Before Christmas were also working, or they were working on the Gumby movie after production wrap. And they were like, wow, we had to work so hard on that movie. And it's just so laid back on the Gumby movie. There's a reason. That movie's awful.
And one of those people came from the rebooted Gumby show of the 80s, it'd be in You Watch, too. So.
Yeah.
But it wasn't just Gumby. They also were folks coming from ILM, which, that, you know, ILM was pioneering in computer graphics, but a lot of Star Wars is some version of stop motion as well. And same with Phil Tippett Studios, too, which did a lot of work on, like, say, RoboCop.
Yeah, and Pixar would be developing. Pixar had existed, right,
Pixar,
at this point,
yeah,
in Emeryville, in our neck of the woods.
Yep, owned in part by Lucas and Steve Jobs, the Apple man himself. So.
We could walk to Pixar and then get escorted out of the premises if we wanted to.
I mean, we could. Well, it's too smoky outside today. But in 20 minutes, me and you could be outside of Phil Tippett Studios right now, Bob.
Slamming on that door.
I want to see Ed 209. Show me. So they're building up all the stuff. Elfman is writing the songs. It's 18 months of pre-production, and the script still isn't ready yet. They don't have all the scenes. The art team that Selleck has hired, they can't storyboard everything without the script either. They've got three songs, so they start with What's This? What's This is the first thing filmed for the movie. And they're working on it as Elfman is recording the songs. To get the script together, Caroline Thompson, she was living with Elfman at the time, as she would put it. She knew all the songs because she's having to hear them all day long living with this guy. So they hire her to write the script that kind of stitches it all together. As Selleck kind of tells it, though, they'd get the script and be like, let's rework every single piece of this and make it work for our storyboards and for these characters. And then Caroline would see what they did of tearing it apart, and then she'd rewrite all of that to try to get it back to what she had. And it just sounds like a real push and pull of who wrote it. So she is the credited screenwriter, but also I think the storyboarders rewrote a lot of stuff. And they, like, one of the lead storyboarders was Joe Ranft, who, the late Joe Ranft, who is one of the top story guys at Pixar. They always talk about
the voice of Heimlich.
The penguin, right?
No, Heimlich is the caterpillar from A Bug's Life.
Oh, okay.
And the penguin as well, yeah.
He is the penguin, okay, yeah.
He passed away, like, during The Corpse Bride, I think, was being made.
I believe so. Actually, yeah. Again, like within walking distance from here, it was on like a Berkeley highway.
It's
quite sad. But she's writing the script. It's finally starting to come together, and they're stitching it. Ranft is working on it. There's also Eric Layton is one that is supervising animator on it. He would go on to direct Dinosaur. I think that's his only directing credit.
Poor bastard.
He's also animation director on Sherlock Gnome. That's his most recent one. So hey,
don't like that.
You got to pay the bills somehow. A staff of up to 120 people worked on this film. And in my research too, I didn't understand just how strenuous a job it is to do this, because you have these foot to 3 feet tall puppets, basically, or things you're posing around, and you have to, like, almost like James Bond around laser lights, you have to manipulate yourself around these puppets to push them into position.
And everything is, every shot is so carefully planned. And I guess we should explain, the puppets are, they basically have like robot skeletons inside, like metal skeletons, and then there's a puppet around that. Nothing is like clay or plasticine or whatever in this world.
And with a headpiece that you replace to do the mouth movements.
Yeah.
Including Jack, who had like, you know, at least 100 heads. Forget the count.
Some characters have like mouths that are moved independently. There's not like a new head they pop on, but the ones that have new pop-on heads, you can tell, like Jack and Sally, they are the pop-on head figures.
Yeah,
characters.
Some people, like the jazz saxophonist, he just has kind of a puppety up down mouth. It doesn't, you know, there's different levels of complexity, but Jack as the lead in it has some very complex mouth movements. Or also you'll notice on the mayor, he just has like a very clear just flap that gets changed.
I love that
out every time.
That's so cool.
So Elfman's score gets finalized in late 1991. He sang all the songs and also, in their original temp track of it, provided the speaking voice of Jack. Burton also cast a lot of his favorites, including Catherine O'Hara, as both Sally and Shock. The character of Sally grew and grew in their writing. Late in it, they gave her a song, partially because Elfman was inspired by his relationship with Caroline to put Sally in there. Like, there's a lot of Caroline and Elfman's relationship in Sally and Jack.
Yeah, I really like Elfman's singing voice, and the speaking voice is Chris Sarandon. I don't know what he was famous for at this time. I still don't know what he is famous for.
Oh, I know.
What was he famous for?
He was Humperdinck in The Princess Bride. Oh, that was what he was most famous
for. That's right. Okay, yeah. But I think their voices are so similar, I just was like, why didn't they just make a Danny Elfman doing the talking voice? It's just so weird, because in some songs, it'll be like the first word of the lead is Chris Sarandon, and then the next word is Danny Elfman.
It's very distracting. Henry Selick takes the blame for that. So Selick felt that Elfman's voice acting outside of singing was not strong enough.
And he
wanted to recast it. But to get permission to do that, he had to go up to Burton. And so it was Burton who broke the news to Elfman. And it actually did cause a brief rift in the relationship of Burton and Elfman.
Wow.
Elfman was really insulted that they cut his speaking part from it.
God, I guess I've never heard him act, but his singing is so powerful and emotional that I wouldn't understand why he wouldn't be able to act normally.
Yeah, I don't think I've heard any of what his was, but it was what his version of the lines were in speaking, but it was his call, it was Selick's call, Burton seemed to agree with it. Believe this might not be true, but I did read one bit of trivia said, the reason Danny Elfman doesn't do the soundtrack to Ed Wood is because he wasn't working with Burton at the time in anger that Howard Shore did Ed Wood.
Okay, yeah. That was struck me as strange, like why he was not on that movie. It seemed perfect for him.
But other voice actors included the returning Otho as the mayor. You got Paul Reubens, Pee-wee himself, as Locke of Locke, Shock, and Beryl. Beryl is voiced by... No, Shock is Elfman... Shock is O'Hara, Beryl is Elfman.
That's right. And he was sort of in like movie jail probation where he was slowly being released back into the wild where he was in Batman Returns as the Penguin's dad and then in this as the little devil boy. Beryl? No, Shock.
Yeah,
Locke.
He's Locke.
Okay,
I know he's Locke for sure. I know that.
All I can remember is them saying their names once and then that's it.
But 3 years earlier, they would have advertised the crap out of Pee-wee Herman being a lead voice or a major voice. And also William Hickey, the grumpy old man himself.
He was always
Dr. Finkelstein.
I think he was only in his 50s that he died, but he was always the oldest sounding man. And in fact, Bill and Josh for The Simpsons, they wanted him to play Officer Brodka that episode Marjorie Not Proud, but he was just too old and sick.
He was... he'd be dead by the time that Brodka episode aired, or maybe right after. Like he still had 4 or 5 years left on him when the film released. But
And also so good as Pete and Pete's grandfather with the haunted bowling ball.
Oh, perfect. Yeah, he's such a just wonderful man, and he's great as this controlling like monster that he is in this, but who kind of is like bipolar and goes from cruelty to now I can let you out now.
God, what a perfect voice that guy had.
And originally they did hope that the narrator would be Vincent Price and also Santa Claus, that he'd do both of those. Vincent Price still would live. He'd be alive when they were recording it, but his wife passed away and he was apparently so despondent he just didn't do anything. They couldn't, even his best friend Tim Burton, who just had him in Edward Scissorhands, couldn't get him to record the dialogue for it. It's quite sad. So instead they went with Edward Ivory as Santa Claus, another Bay Area actor. I think they did consider Patrick Stewart. Patrick Stewart did record stuff for it.
Yeah, I don't know who the narrator is. So there's like a narrator in the beginning of the movie.
I believe it's Ivory as well.
Yeah, I think you're right. But on the soundtrack for this movie, it includes the Patrick Stewart opening, and I believe it also includes a Patrick Stewart epilogue that talks about how Jack and Sally had children. And I also think on the soundtrack album, if there's a line that Sarandon does in the movie, it's Elfman doing it. It's all Elfman. There are some differences between the soundtrack and the movie.
Yeah, that's it. You know, maybe
I've heard it a lot, by the way.
Maybe Walt Disney Records signed a different deal with those people. Like, no, you signed the deal for this, you can't change it. So
yeah, or they couldn't use Sarandon's voice on an album or something like that.